Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning.
Welcome
everybody.
To Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, our guest today is none other than socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin Waldman. We're going to speak to him about a lot of issues which will come up. But before we do that, you should know that he also has his own consultancy, which focuses on labor market demographic analyses, understanding labor markets and their changes, and how they can help the public officials at all levels of government in determining what policies will best serve their respective communities. And that's we're going to bring that up, I think, quite a bit today. And you could find his website at econlabor, econlabor.com. And so good morning, Professor. Great to speak to you today, as always.
Good morning.
Well, very interesting essay that you wrote again. Thankfully, we hear from you every 2 weeks, and it increases our capacity to understand what's going on. And the essay that you wrote is called The Problem with a Deeply Entrenched Neoclassical Orthodoxy. And can you explain a little bit of that? Why is it that we have a neoclassical model of competitive markets that goes back to an orthodoxy that really isn't serving the public interest? Is it really just serving the economic interest of big business? Is that it?
Well, it's a model. It's a theoretical construct. And if you don't have any data to back it up, it sounds nice. It almost sounds scientific. It's a way for economists to sort of separate themselves from the subject matter, or for subjects, separate themselves from people, actually, and say, well, I'm looking at this model of how the economy works. And it'll basically explain how people behave in the marketplace. But we don't necessarily have to view the actors in the marketplace as people per se, rather reviewing them as firms and workers. Workers are not even people, they're labor. Labor are inputs in the production process, and they're essentially commodities in that production process. So they have no personalities, they have no real needs. And in fact, what you've done is you've dehumanized the worker by viewing that worker as nothing more, nothing less than a commodity. And then from there, it's very easy to say, okay, so let's look at the unemployment rate. Oh, if we have to fight inflation by raising interest rates, well, okay, so we'll just require fewer inputs in the production process. Without we're actually laying actual people off. Who have to feed themselves and their families.
Mm-hmm. And well, you pointed this out even a few years ago, how we dismiss the teenager that's trying to earn a couple of bucks, and we forget that they might actually be subsidizing or assisting the family to be able to put food on the table or pay the rent. And the same thing goes with our older a population who cannot afford to retire. They don't have a retirement plan. They have absolutely nothing. And they've come of age, and they may not be hireable, so they may end up getting a job at a fast food store, but they don't get paid very much either. But they're in their 60s and 70s and even 80s. If they're agile enough to be able to function to some extent, they may be cleaning the bathroom or maybe serving food, whatever it is that they're assigned to do. Why have we dismissed both of these age groups from the dynamic? And why do we keep them employed? Can't we afford to employ other people who will be who need a full-time job?
Well, again, the neoclassical model focuses on efficiency. Question is, how do you get the most efficiency in your economy? Well, the two maximums in economics are, well, maximize your profit or utility to your consumer and minimize your costs. So we don't look at workers as a fixed cost. Not that we ever did, but you know, it's sort of it's somewhat of a humorous notion when you think about it. It's like, I mean, I've served on any number of years on a budget committee for a college, and basically the whole attitude was, well, we have rising costs. They're fixed costs. What's a rising fixed cost? Well, the utility bill is going up. That's a fixed cost. Well, why is that a fixed cost as opposed to workers? Workers are not a fixed cost thing. I mean, their wages can be cut. Well, if they're not cut, at least you freeze their salaries. So in effect, as the cost of living goes up and your wages don't, it's analogous to a pay cut, an effective pay cut. And basically, that's the way we view workers, and they're basically discretionary spending when you think about it. So if their cost becomes too high, then you find ways to cut, reduce the need for those particular inputs. You cut back on the inputs that you will, in fact, purchase. And what you're viewing the worker at, the McDonald's, is simply an input. It's not really a person. And so you're purchasing fewer inputs as the price goes up. And that's the way the model basically presents it. In other words, your demand, as the cost of labor increases, employers will demand less of their services. In other words, they will purchase fewer of those inputs. That's the way it's often couched in terms of the neoclassical terminology. And again, it's a nice way of avoiding the fact that you're really talking about people and how they behave in the marketplace. The employer then, who reduces his or her cost, is not necessarily seen as a nasty individual who's selfish, who's trying to hoard it over his or her workers. Rather, he's a nice guy who's simply following the dictates of the model and reducing costs.
Well, that's what I found so compelling about your essay, in the sense that big business or even small business, they abide by this construct that's been accepted for I don't know how many decades. Why is there no populist candidate that says, you know what, we're failing the people that we are subsidizing with funding and training and this, that, and the other, but at the end they're not getting anywhere. And it's costing our economy all this money to subsidize them, and yet they're not really, or they're barely getting by. So why isn't there a populist that says, hey, this has got to stop, and a big business shouldn't have a guarantee of low cost in their workers? Or is that going to bring about, you know, the machinery that's going to clean up your hotel room or vacuum the floors so that you don't employ people? Is that what's happening now? Is the economy and big business going to totally dismiss the worker?
It's possible. Machinery, workers, they're basically interchangeable parts in the production process. That's sort of the way the model views it. So in other words, if human capital becomes too costly, you substitute technology for that human capital. You know, the United States is supposedly a capital-intensive country, whereby you have more capital and fewer workers, relatively speaking. And China, for example, is a labor-intensive country. You have more workers than you have technology. And since you have so many workers, it's so cheap to employ innumerable workers, whereas it costs more to employ a particular worker in the United States. That's the way we tend to view it. And again, what the model does is it depersonalizes everything.
Yeah, it does. It evidently does. Can America, for example, fight off the cheaper products that are, produced in China or in Vietnam or in Indonesia or whatever country you want to look at, and still have a system that can pay a better a living wage to its population? Or are we getting to the point now where society is going to need to say, okay, well, we're going to get technology to supplant our workers. We basically don't even realize that they're there, or we don't care. And we're going to need to actually pay everybody a wage, even though they may not be working. So the machines are going to do the work. How are we going to put this together?
Well, I don't think the United States is quite there yet. Basically, it's still wedded to this idea of achieving efficiency. It has not really embraced the idea of giving people dignity in work. Once it does that, then we can talk about higher wages so people have dignity in their work. Once we have a vision of the society we want to create, then we can talk about how we get there. We don't have a vision, and that's part of the problem with the economic recession. Generally speaking, there is no vision of a better society. The vision is predicated on this idea that a good society is an efficient society. An efficient marketplace is a good marketplace. An efficient economy is a prosperous marketplace, prosperous economy. That's the way we view it in a neoclassical model. And basically, the end result is a lot of people end up suffering as a result. And you also have a lot of inequality that flows from that.
Well, doesn't the cost of subsidizing the worker who is not earning or is getting the minimum wage, doesn't it cost us money when we see them at the hospital or when we give them some sort of benefits for food or to subsidize their rent and stuff like that? That's not coming from big business, is it? Or are they being taxed to death, the big business? So they figure, okay, well, we may be taxed to the point where we have to pay, and this money goes to the unknown worker who we dismiss as irrelevant and just a machine as far as we're concerned. How do we rationalize this? And how do we expect somebody on Wall Street who may be making hundreds of thousands of dollars, and even the workers that clean up the offices, they probably make very little as well. So how do we put it together, or are we blind to all of this?
I think the story of this, we're blind to it all because we choose not to see it, and we basically tell ourselves that it's okay because, you know, there are subsidies in place and they'll be taken care of with those subsidies. As far as the person working on Wall Street is concerned, this person has enough deductions in the tax code. So if you raise his or her marginal tax rate, they have enough deductions to offset it. So their effective tax rate really does not change a whole lot, if it changes at all. And that's really what's been going on. As far as who pays for this, we all pay for this because the corporations pass on the cost to us when they are taxed at a greater rate. So the thinking is, well, we're all paying for it and we can all take care of one another. But we're not necessarily viewing these people in need as people per se. We're viewing them as the labor market statistics, and so we refer to them as.
Well, why is it that it's so difficult for people to comprehend that maybe mom and dad at home, they're barely eking an existence, and that when grandma and grandpa, assuming that they're nimble enough to work, they may be getting a job at a fast food joint, and their teenage son or daughter, they're also getting a job, and yet that still doesn't meet the needs of a family because they either are spending too much time in a menial job and not getting the education to help them reach a higher level of competence and compensation with money. So why is this okay? And why do we sustain the very, very poor and uneducated in our system by not elevating them to a higher place, couldn't they also benefit society overall? What are we afraid of, that we won't be able to afford to employ them at $15 an hour as opposed to whatever?
I don't think we want to pay the cost of employing those $15 an hour. We want cheap goods and services, so we want lower prices. So we basically turn the other way. Again, we're not viewing them as people. We're viewing them as inanimate objects. They're labor inputs. And labor inputs can be reduced in terms of their cost. If the cost of gas goes up, I simply drive fewer miles. I reduce my gas consumption.
Right.
If the cost of production goes up, I reduce the cost of production by reducing the number of inputs I need in the labor process. That's all. And that's the way we view it. The neoclassical model has facilitated this view by turning workers into these commodities in the production process.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer people who have needs. We do the same thing when we lay them off. We say, well, we didn't lay off workers. We have statistics out there. We have unemployed. They are part of the statistics now. They don't necessarily have needs. We give these we have greater number of claims being made against the unemployment insurance system. Again, it's a very impersonal process. And in fact, because you have that in place, it's very easy for the employer to say, I'm simply reducing my inputs right now because it's too costly. We're in a recession. The inputs will be taken care of by the UI system. You don't see your workers as people. In fact, you go out of your way not to see them as people. You basically, you shut yourself off in your ivory tower, in your office park, and you have no interaction with your workers at all. So they're nothing to you. You have no connection to them.
Amazing. So is this orthodoxy only adopted here in the United States? Is it similar to Canada? For example, you could buy a shirt at some sort of discount store, and it may cost you $5 or $10 or $20, whereas if you go to a higher-end store, it may cost you $50 or $75 or $100 for a shirt. But then if you want to buy a shirt from Switzerland, it'll cost you $250. How is it that they can afford to charge $250? Are they paying their worker that much more than we are over here? Because we wouldn't be able to sell a shirt for $250 unless you're at the very high end and you like the quality of the material, which is going to be a lot more expensive than the material that may be sold here at for a $5 or $20 shirt.
Well,
are we an anomaly on the marketplace, or are we a norm?
No, we're actually the norm. The neoclassical model permeates the economic profession worldwide. Basically, it's an orthodoxy which every economist is expected to buy into if they want to they hope to have a job. And if they don't, they won't have a job. So it's neoclassical economists all over the world, and basically this is what informs much of public policy around the world. Now, if you have some countries which have more of a welfare state, that's only because you have a competing vision there, which basically says, look, we need somebody to pick up the slack for the failures of the marketplace. A welfare state is probably justified on the basis of market failure. In other words, you have market failure when insufficient number of people have jobs. You have market failure when you have a large enough population that's simply unable to earn a decent living, that they need subsidies. That's a market failure, too. And I would suspect what we're going to see in the next few months, as with all the talk of inflation in the United States, we are going to see the Fed raise interest rates and increase the reserve requirements of the banks, thereby tightening up the money supply. This inevitably will lead to a recession. And again, the idea here is, well, you know, the workers who will lose out, they're simply inanimate objects. It's for the good of the community, so the argument goes, that they will lose their jobs. But again, it's nothing personal. They're inanimate objects, and that's the way the system works.
Mm-hmm. So this, we're not going to be able to eclipse this whole dynamic. It's a setup, and that's the way it's going to be. So why do we talk a good game, and yet we can't seem to raise the minimum wage even to $15 an hour? Is it that detrimental to the entire system? What's it going to do?
It's not detrimental to the whole system, but it's a threat to certain people's businesses in the country, that they will have to absorb that cost of paying the workers more. And if you're talking about, you know, comparing workers in New York, where $15 probably is inadequate, you probably would need $25 an hour at a minimum, versus Iowa, where $7.25 an hour is probably takes you quite far. You know, there are going to be people who say you need differential minimum wages based on the part of the country you happen to be in. The federal minimum wage doesn't take into account wage differentials throughout the country or differences in cost of living. So that's your basic problem.
Wow. So where do we go from here? Or do we just stay exactly the way we are now?
You know, it would be a step in the right direction if more economists could come along and say there are problems with the neoclassical model. With those dominant model, there are clearly problems with it. Simply calling it unfair is not good enough. You need to point out its shortfalls in the terms, the same terms that neoclassical economists use. You know, I've had a number of students who basically said to me, "I don't like this model. It's not fair." Okay. That's very nice. There's a lot to criticize the model, but you need to understand it before you criticize. Now, the problem that you have is this is what people are taught in economics courses throughout the world. And you need to teach them something else. There used to be a time, when, at least when you think about, say, Adam Smith, when we actually grouped economics and politics together, and we taught in terms of political economy. Now, economics has been separated from political science, and economics is viewed as some kind of more scientific endeavor, largely because it has mathematical equations in it. But the reality is, there's nothing very scientific about economics at all. If anything, it's called dismal science by Malthus. So, you know, it's not really scientific at all. But economists want to think they're scientific. And the way they can do this is create this terminology and basically depersonalize the subject matter. So whereas while we're talking about the behavior of individuals, which is what economics is really about, it's about explaining people's behavior in the marketplace, how they respond to various stimuli, incentives, and disincentives. In the case of the marketplace, the incentives are lower costs or disincentives, higher costs associated with the transaction. But that's really all that economics is. You know, you're trying to explain behavior. It's really not about what the interest rate is and what the unemployment rate is and what the Fed is going to do tomorrow.
So when did we change our policy of, there used to be a time, I don't know, exactly when. I'm sure a few decades back, maybe two or three decades back, where the boss was may have earned two or three times more than the lowest paid worker in a particular operation, and now it's gone through the roof, and I don't know, maybe 1,000 times more than the lowest paid worker. When did we remove the humanity in our lowest paid worker? And I realize at the end, you've got very wealthy people in China who are billionaires, and we got people in Indonesia the same way, and in Vietnam, and you also got people who are very poor. So why is this dynamic now okay when it wasn't at one time, and we tried to keep things at, you know, less divided or less divisive? So where are we going with this?
I think part of it is that we, I would think that some point during the 80s, we began to glorify selfishness and greed.
Uh-huh.
Like the old Wall Street movie, Greed is Good.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people began to believe that. And, you know, let me get as much for myself as I possibly can. That's what keeps the system going. So the argument goes, the more I make, the more I can invest. The more I can invest, the more good I can do for others. But it starts with myself. I got to take as much as I can. And if I'm not, then there's something wrong with me. And we've glorified that, even at the expense of workers. And we've rewarded, shareholders with good shareholder value. So if you make an investment in a company, then the expectation is that the shareholder will be rewarded with good stock prices and value. And one of the things that you want to convey to the shareholder is that you are mindful of the cost of the production process, that you are taking into account what's necessary to achieve efficiency. That means paying attention to workers' wage rates and making sure that those wage rates are not so rigid. You want the workers to be flexible in their demands. If necessary, the workers are not complying with your demands, then you close up the operation, you move your capital out of the country, and open up someplace where wage rates are a fraction of what they are here. And okay. I think that's coming to haunt us right now, as we are into the third year of this pandemic. A lot of our supply chain crisis has to do with the fact that we are importing a lot of our necessary items for production process, the commodities, from China, as well as finished goods. And if China is going to adopt a policy of locking down whole communities every time a new variant comes along and keep them under lock and key for 3-4 months at a time, yes, you're going to have a disruption in your supply chain.
One thing that was very interesting, there was a meeting in Davos. It was done through Zoom or some other, you know, telecommunication effort. And big business people, you know, top echelon, whether it was Musk or whether it was whoever they are, because I don't know them all. But the bottom line is they said, we're willing to be taxed more. And these are billionaires, trillionaires, and so on, and even simple millionaires, they were willing to pay more in taxes. Why are they willing to pay more in taxes? And if so, does that mean that business will also be paying more in taxes, or is it just them who are the beneficiaries of their companies and they're going to pay more taxes? But it's going to amount to like $35 trillion just in the collection of these taxes. What's that going to do for economies like here in the United States where people are not even earning $15 an hour? What are we going to do with that money? Where's it going to go?
Well, I suppose that's what politics is all about, deciding how much you want to spend new taxes, and we're not always agreed on that. So, you know, obviously the left would like to spend it on people, investing in communities and educational systems and health care, and maybe even some kind of universal basic income. Whereas the right will say, well, see what's happening in the, on the border of the Ukraine, so that shows you why we need more spending on military and defenses. And, of course, there are those who will say, with the rising crime wave, it's clear we need to spend more money on police departments. Things that have been defunded over the last year and a half. So we need to reinvest in those enterprises. So just because you have new tax revenues doesn't mean the money will go to the people who may need programs the most.
Well, what's so compelling about, you know, this essay and so many of the others that you write every 2 weeks that you share with us, I guess what's interesting is that there seems to be a change, but will that change ever be reflected in our economy? And at the same time, how will we spend it? So are we interested in elevating our capacity to employ people, or do we want to keep them under lock and key by subsidizing them and not training them? So are we becoming enlightened, or are we just doubling down on the way we control our people that we have at the lower socioeconomic ladder? And for what purpose are we doing this? Is this supposed to look good? But it's not going to change anything.
I think what people are not telling you is the following. If we have inflation, and the Fed responds the way the Fed's supposed to respond, by raising interest rates. So the consequence of that will be a recession. With a recession, you're going to have layoffs and people losing their jobs. Well, for some people, that's actually a good thing. The more people are unemployed, the more docile these people become, and the more willing they are to take lower wages. What Marx called the Industrial Reserve Army of Labor. We need it. Capitalism, he said, needs industrial reserve army of labor, people whom you can lay off or you can threaten to lay off by having them look at the industrial reserve army of labor out there and say, look, you take this low wage or you'll be one of them.
Wow. So what sort of dogma are we hearing from either these so-called progressives that are in government and those that are want to hold on to whatever concepts have been already inculcated in the nation? Is there really a battle royale for a more balanced segmentation of our society? Or, you know, are we just talking with different words that are meaningless at the end of the day also? What are we trying to accomplish? Because there seems to be some sort of introspection in America, isn't there? I don't know if we have an introspection in Europe or if we have it in Asia or in Africa, not, I'm sure not, or even in South America.
I have not seen any great introspection here in the United States. I have not seen any great ideas coming from the progressives. It's more of the same old ideas that have bandied about, which have really gotten us nowhere. What I do see is a lot of the politics of diversion and deflection, and basically you're focusing on issues which are a sideshow because you really don't know what to do about the pressing problems of the day. It's when somebody like Biden goes down to Atlanta, gives a speech about a voting rights bill, which has nothing to do with traditional civil rights. When he talks about if you're not voting for him or his bill, then you must be George Wallace or Bull Connor. I think this is the kind of diversion which people are getting upset about. And it's also pushing, as it turns out, Hispanics into the Republican camp, because then they're saying, look, you're not speaking for me. And we really want it's only to address the economic issues, the standard of living, the inflation, and the fact that we're not making decent livings. That's what they really want. But we have progressives who don't have an answer, and they'd rather change the subject. this is an old story. And I just see more of it coming from progressives. For another thing, who said recently, said you have a hostage taking in a synagogue in Texas. It's not anti-Semitism. But let's talk about hate, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. What are we trying to do? Because we are allowing a lot of people to come in. We actually welcome them into the country. I heard that there are about 700 people from Afghanistan who were permitted to come into the country. They came across the Mexican border. We flew them up to Westchester County, you know, and we're going to employ them here. Okay, great. And we're going to give them housing. And what's interesting is that because they come from Afghanistan, we're going to let them stand before others that have been waiting for housing, affordable housing, and these people are going to get it before the people who have been waiting for affordable housing maybe for 5 or 10 years. What are we doing? Can we afford to bring all these people in without an education, without the capacity for language? And what are they going to do? And how come we're subsidizing them and not subsidizing the people who are already here? Where does this go? It's gone crazy, it seems to me.
That's one of the issues.
Not that I have
that,
anything against the Afghanis, don't get me wrong.
That's one of the issues that that we're sort of forced to address. You know, when we talk about equity in terms of outcomes,
mm-hmm.
that's another trope of the progressives, you know, the equity. So now, when it comes to giving out medications, therapeutics for treating COVID in emergency
mm-hmm.
rooms, we have to take into account people who are at high risk. Ones now at high
mm-hmm.
risk, if they're of a particular ethnic or racial group that has suffered because of historic inequities in the system. You know, that's the new language. And basically, you're not taking into account one's real health risks in terms of your triage. You know, I suppose with regard to the Afghanis, you sort of have a moral social contract here. Help fight the war against terrorism. They serve as translators to leave them behind to be slaughtered by the Taliban would be to go back on our obligations. That would stop the
uh-huh.
United States. We've done that before. And the fact that you left Americans behind seems to be something that the president doesn't want to hear anything about. But, you know, it is an issue for some. How can you talk about why are you concerned about the borders of the Ukraine, but you're not concerned about the southern border in the United States? Why are you talking about
no clue.
Vaccinations and vaccine mandates in the United States, which will let people come across the border who have not been checked
unchecked.
For COVID, who have not been yeah. tested, and have not been vaccinated?
Right. I don't get it. I don't understand the rationale for it. I'm just flummoxed by it all. It just seems like we're in such chaos, and yet at the same time there's a cry for something different, but we don't have the intellectual capacity, you know, except for people like you, who bring up these issues that actually demand that we find resolution of some sort, at least a beginning process to get to the point where what are we trying to accomplish? And by subsidizing people for the rest of their lives, what are we gaining from that other than their own subservience to us? Or are we buying votes? Is this what we're trying to do? Are we buying votes for one side of the equation or the other? You know, where's this going to go?
Well, again, if you take the Marxist approach, basically you're subsidizing them to keep them quiet. You're purchasing their quiescence. Now, I mean, it's not just Marx that said that, but you know, none other than Anthony Downs said that, and he's a good neoclassical economist too.
Uh-huh.
You know, and basically what you're doing is you're keeping them quiet, you're purchasing acquiescence, while you, by the elite, can continue to profit.
Mm-hmm. So actually, we're just stuck at this particular juncture, and we may not even realize collectively, collectively, we're not even thinking of finding a new route or building a new road. So we're just wallowing here, and it seems to either eclipse people's concept of what's really going on, or exhausted because we've been talking about this for maybe last 10, 20 years, and we haven't evolved from the time when we moved into the production line in the 40s in the automobile industry. So how do we even stay competitive? Are we failing even there because we're allowing China to produce everything and we're becoming subservient to them in every conceivable way?
We are not competitive with China if we're talking about what China is able to pay its workers. We are not competitive with any country that has a single-payer healthcare system. We're not competitive with any country which is willing to relax all regulations. So here we talk about green energy and, you know, climate change, and we need to do what we need to do for our environment. And yet, there's no way that countries like China want to enter those kinds of agreements where they would raise their production costs. They're simply not going to do that. We're willing to invest in China. While we're talking about green energy here, we're willing to invest in China. We're willing to pay the cost of purchasing from China. It's hypocrisy. There's no other way to describe it. But the same people who are talking about green energy here are profiting from their investments in China.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, for example, it's supposed to be one of the most sophisticated what's the term that they use? It's a place where they do the computer technology in Taiwan, and China said, well, we're going to take Taiwan whenever we feel like it. And people are suggesting that maybe in 4 or 5 years they'll just invade, and there's nothing that anybody else can do about it. But the point is, we're not planning, and we don't have these silicon wafer things that we use for computer systems. We're not building one over here. What do we do when we don't have any of that facility and capacity here in the United States? Are we going to become subservient to the power that be, and at that point, will it be China? I don't think it's going to be Russia. They're not going very far very quickly. But it looks like China's got it all under control. They don't have the wages that we offer, and yet we're not competitive. So they seem to control the entire world economy, no matter how you look at it. Even Europe, they're not functioning either. So what is functioning? Is it only China that's functioning?
At the moment, they're functioning. I mean, I suppose we're muddling on through as best as we can. So is the rest of the world. But, I just don't see us pursuing a policy where it's going to cost us anything. And again, workers, for all the talk about this commitment to the middle class, this commitment to the workers of the United States, I don't think anybody in the political class really cares.
Mm-hmm. And what about the unions? How come they're not fighting for a different sort of equity? Or are they only interested instead of getting whatever, $15 an hour, they're looking for 16, or if they're earning 25, they're looking for 28? What are we trying to accomplish here? Is it just to get a pay increase and the union could say, well, we got you a pay increase. Instead of 25, you're now getting 28. And is that affordable?
It depends on what part of the country you're in. but the unions are concerned about themselves. This has basically been the classic problem with unions. Basically, it's an adversarial relationship. They're not political unions. They're not the base of political parties, as they are in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the trade union movement in the United States is really a question of getting as much for the workers from the capitalists as they possibly can for the workers, period. End of discussion. They don't really care about
people
not members of the unions. They're not concerned about people who belong to other unions. They're concerned about themselves and the workers who are working for a specific company. How much can they get for themselves? And clearly, if the more employers are earning for themselves, and in other words, as that ratio grows up, the pay of the workers and the pay of the CEOs, then the unions feel they have a better bargaining chip to say, look, you're hoarding it over your workers. We want some of that too. We're not talking about fairness and justice for workers across the country or around the world for that matter. They're simply talking about here's this company. It's making this tremendous profit. We want a piece of that pie for us.
Right.
And that's been the fundamental problem with the union movement in the United States. It has a very limited vision.
Well, you know, it's very insightful of you, and I have to admit, even though I thought it was halfway intelligent, but evidently it went right over my head. But the truth is, why isn't the union movement in the United States becoming more concerned about people who are not unionized? Why don't they reach out and try to get the fast food worker and so that they can become unionized? Why can't we support those people to strike, against the coffee barista who isn't getting paid, and so on and so forth? What's holding that up? As if the responsibility is only for one particular franchise to put up what they don't even have. Financially, they can't even afford to go on strike. They earn so little. So why are we falling down on a line? We talk a good game, but we're not delivering to our own people or the people that we want to live with in society.
Well, it is hard to
organize.
We don't
respect those guys, people making coffee.
It's hard to organize workers who are poorly paid, and especially if you don't have any strike fund to provide for them during a strike. It's hard to organize workers in states. We have right to work laws, which make it almost impossible to organize because, you have an open shop. So there's no requirement that the workers be members of the union. These are the challenges you have that the unions are faced. They basically are confronted with the challenge of a legal structure, which really is against them. The legal structure and institutions in place have been militating against unionism for the last 30 years now, and that's very difficult to change. It requires a president who's going to make more pro-union, pro-labor appointments to the National Labor Relations Board. But even there, even if you have a National Labor Relations Board case that would be ruled in favor of the workers, that case can always be appealed directly to the Supreme Court. When you have a conservative majority, it's highly unlikely it'll be ruled in favor of workers against the interest of business. That's one of the reasons why I found it somewhat distressing during the last few rounds of confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justices. Nobody brought up the question of where these people stood with regards to the rights of workers versus the rights of capitalists.
So we really shouldn't be expecting anything from labor through their unions. They're not going to be fighting for making the fast food joint unionized because we're not going to be able to pay for a particular shop to allow these people to demonstrate around the fast food joint for maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or 4 weeks, whatever, and literally shut them down. because we're paying the workers not to work. And then they could become also members of the union. Why can't the Teamsters reach out to these people? And don't they want more people to be employed so that they can also pay for the dues? And doesn't the union want to grow even more powerful?
The unions would love to grow. I think they do care. They would like to grow. But they feel powerless given the current realities. And membership has been declining over the last 30 years. So they basically are a skeleton of themselves, what they were in an earlier period of time. And they have not been able to get beyond the firm-wide basis for organizations to an industry-wide basis for organizations. Mm-hmm. So you do that. I don't think the unions having any real pull. The other problem that the unions have is that, you know, they've had been instrumental in getting policies that are beneficial to workers enacted. But, you know, you need a Congress that's supportive of that. And for years, we did not have a Congress that was supportive. Maybe you do in terms of your composition in the House right now, but it's a very limited margin that would support workers, and you don't even have full consensus in the Democratic Party in terms of what's good for workers, but rather the focus of the progressives is we only care about poor workers or equity between workers. And so that's the problem. And if you don't have the support of people in the Senate, then you're not going to get anywhere. That's one of the reasons why I think it would be important for unions to talk about various policies in terms of how they help benefit the middle class, the larger middle class, not just the poor. If you focus on the poor, the poor are stigmatized, and nobody cares about the poor. You're not going to get so many support, much support that way. And until unions learn to play that game, I don't see us moving anywhere. We're just treading water.
So why don't we have that mental dexterity from the unions? Are there not, you know, brilliant people who are in the union business, you know, at the higher end of their operations so that they could say, hey, let's reach out? Are they afraid? Or what are they afraid of?
Yeah, I don't know if they have the vision. I don't know. Some of them may be afraid of losing their positions. Some of them may feel this has been the mission of the Institute organization for so long, we can't change it now. And I think increasingly, unfortunately, because we have where everything's wrapped up in world politics these days, if you use the term no middle class, that may be code for, well, you mean white workers. You mean the middle class. The middle class includes all workers within a certain income range. And that's the focus, what it should be, not this idea of just white workers. But that may be what progressives are thinking when you use the term middle class. It's code for white workers. And I think a lot of them are sort of put off by this idea that a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, that's something that the capitalists like to say. And to a certain extent, there's some truth to that. But they don't want to, they want to talk about the rights of the poor versus the capitalists. It's much easier, they think, and you get more political bang for your buck when you couch it in terms of class warfare as opposed to really the needs of the middle class.
Mm-hmm. So are we just hearing, are we hearing polemics from one side of the equation or the other? Is it just, you know, like people finger-pointing and say you're failing or you're not failing? And so we're just in calcitrance. We're just sitting where we are, and we're not looking for any changes. We're not looking for any innovation. Is that where we are right now? We're in a form of stasis. We're just standing still, but we talk a good game, and that's part of that diversion. Is it the problem that we're using language that is just not conducive to what our issues are? Are we in denial?
Some people are in denial. I think other people are basically very cynical about the politics they play. And basically, it's more important to create the illusion that you're doing something than to actually be doing something.
Yeah, I guess so, unfortunately. Well, unfortunately, Professor, we're at the end of our time slot. I really need to spend a little bit of time telling people about the work that you've accomplished already and the books that you've written, and it'll give us a little bit of time to before our next guest. So as usual, thank you for an exhilarating, I hope I haven't diminished your capacity, but you've certainly escalated mine to better understand what's going on. Thank you very, very much. Be well. Well, here we have it, folks, none other than Professor Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. His website is econlabor, econlabor.com. You might just want to go there in order to be able to recognize some of the stuff that he's done. Just so you know, Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, he's a labor economist. He specializes in labor market profiling and demographic analysis. He's a research scholar at the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, and he's been on the faculty at the New School, Marist, Bard, and several other institutions over the years. Among his academic appointments, he held the Henry J. Raimondo Endowed Chair in Urban Research and Public Policy at New Jersey City University. For many years, he was a resident scholar at the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. He also taught public policy there. Additionally, he served as a consultant to both public and private ventures and the Community Service Society of New York. He conducted a study of New York City's labor market, specific emphasis on income inequality. He specializes in public policy and political economy, strong interest in political philosophy, and has written extensively on policy issues ranging from welfare reform and workforce development to labor market issues, including unemployment insurance, the minimum wage, and other issues relating to income security. He's the author of several books, including Understanding Public Policy in the United States, published by Top Hat, Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, Arguments for a Minimum Wage, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Then there's The Minimum Wage, a reference handbook by ABC-CLIO, CLIO, and Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory, published by Routledge, and The American Constitution, published by Bridgeport Education, The Political Economy of the Living Wage, a study of four cities. I'm already exhausted by his capacity, and I have not done as well. So let me shame myself now. And then there's, of course, the case of the minimum wage, competing policy models, and reconceiving liberalism, the dilemmas of contemporary liberal library public policy. That's issued by the University of Pittsburgh Press, and so on and so forth. He's got one called Plant Closure, Regulation and Liberalism, The Limits to Liberal Public Policy, and that's published by the University Press of America. Just brilliant work. I hope you'll consider going there. EconLabor, econlabor.com. Well, always a thrill to talk to him, and I always look forward because he captivates my mind. I'm spellbound by his language and his capacity to define policy and to make it understandable even for a simpleton like me who doesn't have his skill and nor his knowledge, which really just makes it fantastic for a simpleton, as they say. Well, I see that we've got Alicia Wiedemann. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Ms. Wiedemann. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Well, what a pleasure to be able to be introduced to you and to meet your acquaintance on the radio. You've got an exemplary resume of accomplishment, but it didn't start yesterday. How did you begin being engaged in advertising and the promotion of new products and, I guess, building a relationship with people and companies? Because the cadre of people that are within your corral are mind-boggling. Every big name under the sun, and the way I understand it, since you opened your operation, you haven't lost one client. That's almost unheard of. This is something that I used to remember that ended up being 40 or 30 years ago, where people cared about the people they represented in advertising and in promotion. What happened, and how did you rediscover this secret? Because you're evidently making a very big success of it.
Yes, yes. So when we founded the company, and, you know, we're coming up on our two-year anniversary, we really were coming out of not a great situation, and we really all took a step back to say, if we're going to do this, if we're going to try to start our own company in April of 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic, right when everything is falling apart, then we're really going to do it on our terms. We're going to create a company that has values, that has a collaborative staff, and that has clients that we're all excited to work together. And I will say, you know, we were very fortunate to have clients that agreed and wanted to come along and wanted to continue that type of relationship, and employees as well. We had amazing employees that were all in without having any idea what kind of job security they were going to have, but they believed in our team. They believed in the vision. And they really believed that we could take a field that was really a little bit at a loss for a while and turn it around and create exactly what you said, relationships, deep, deep relationships that haven't always existed, at least in the last few years.
Well, what's so interesting is the brands that are in your corral and that you serve, and evidently they were hungering for a relationship, which they probably just acquiesced to not having a relationship before. All they did was pay, and they got very little in return. But you picked up companies like E-Trade, Adobe, Chase, I guess the bank, Discover, PayPal, Sony, P&G, Procter & Gamble's, Thomson Reuters, and Pfizer. My God, this is unbelievable what you've accomplished. And in 2 years' time, did they realize, all these companies realize they did not have a relationship and they were being taken for granted and all they were doing was paying? And what do you offer them that's different?
In some cases, we had had a relationship with those companies before. So they knew our team, they knew us, and they were willing to take a chance on us, knowing that we were a new company. But they were willing to take that chance because we had spent years building that relationship and delivering over and over again, regardless of what they were to throw our way or the politics we had to help navigate on their end. So in that case, that was relatively easy. The clients we won were very different. Those clients, you know, in a lot of cases, only started with a tiny job. They would give us a chance to do a video or a small social campaign. And then we had to prove ourselves through the partnership, through our strategic thinking, through our creative capabilities to show them that we could deliver and we could be a partner that they can rely on. And I think, you know, quality work is certainly table stakes. That's certainly something that everybody has to have. Mm-hmm. But building that relationship where we work through the hurdles that they have instead of pushing against them, I think is probably the biggest difference, especially when you look at those larger companies. So many agencies and companies that I've worked at in the past spend so much time fighting the big brands and their processes and their vision and, you know, all of the things that come with that, where we worked with them, worked with their creative departments in some cases, instead of being threatened by them taking over the work. We were there in the background for them to rely on whenever they need it. And it really, really paid off.
Well, that's really very compelling, because I was talking to some people who are involved or vying to get political office. And there was one individual that wanted something written up about an incident that took place, and then he felt he was being marginalized by the political process. And I said, you know, you've got to remove yourself from that sort of atmosphere. Not worry about what they're doing. You need to worry about what you want, and your message is what's important. And if there's credibility in your message, then that's what will survive, and that's what will eclipse the opposition, no matter what sort of dirty tricks that you may think they're going to employ or not. And is that been the lack of focus, even in big business, where they're always worried about the competition but not explaining who they are to the public? Has that been missing?
Yeah, you know, what I think you're hitting on, that we actually have spent a lot of time in just the last few months pivoting and mm-hmm. focusing and pushing our partners on is, yeah, 100%. Companies are so busy watching other companies that they lose sight of the conversation around them. So,
right.
you know,
mm-hmm.
when we do competitive audits, and this is just a small example, we look at certainly their top competitors that they outline, but instead of mm-hmm. just that, we look at who else is talking about the topics that they're interested in, and where are they talking about it? What is the tone that they're using? And leaning honestly more into that than what the competitor is doing, because just watching uh-huh. the competitor is going to get you up to par with the competitor at best, versus looking outside of that and figuring out where you can find your own space.
Mm. Well, one thing that's also very compelling about your demeanor at the firm is that you're not only concerned about the clients that will consider employing you for their benefit, but you also have a tremendous desire and an interest to maintain a relationship with the people that work as part of your operation. How do you keep them engaged? How do you keep them part of a family where they work together and they're not challenged by one another, but rather challenged on how to do a better job so that everybody succeeds in the process? How do you maintain that internally? Because that's huge.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of components to that. I think
yep.
the first thing that we've really focused on is looking at each person individually and not trying to put them in a career path. And we're trained uh-huh. to do that. So that's really hard to break out of. It's something that probably, you know, no large corporation can do. So we're fortunate that we're at a size we can continue to do that. We are
mm-hmm.
really focused on maintaining that as we've grown. But, you know, even when we do our, you know, employee reviews, we don't look at what went wrong, what you can improve on. We look at where you want to go, both personally and professionally, and how can we build a structure and an environment to get you there. And then we even ask, what's your dream?
Right.
Money, career, clients aside, what would you love to see in this company, in this role, that you've never seen anywhere else? And we really push people to think about that, which they're not used to thinking about, especially in an employee review.
Correct. That's really quite brilliant. Again, well, you hit a lot of very, very high-end, concepts that don't challenge many companies, and they don't think about it, so they just go by rote without really thinking very hard about what their expectations are. Because if you don't have expectations, can you arrive at that place by what means if you don't know where you want to go?
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, too many people, and the first time we went through these reviews, it was very hard for people. They didn't
uh-huh.
answer the questions right. They didn't even know, you know, how big to think. So they were a little bit more narrow-minded than you would hope. But we've spent a lot of time training them to think bigger and to push. And And that's also, on the flip side, not to force anyone into a position they don't want. So we've had cases where, you know, we've tried to build a roadmap for people to grow, and they've decided they're happy where they are. They're very happy with their job, and they would love to just stay there. And even understanding that, you know, that career path can go in multiple directions, up and down and laterally, was really big. So people that don't want to be pushed don't need to be pushed. They're doing a great job at what they're doing. They're happy with what they're doing. There's no reason to move them beyond that. I think the other thing that is especially prevalent in the agency space is really understanding the competitive nature that comes into play, and figuring out how to work against that and to get everyone collaborative. So in the past, at every place I've been, there's a competition or a lack of respect between client services, strategy, creative, media, all of those components. And when we recruit people and we bring them in, we spend a ton of time, we put them through a ton of interviews to make sure that they can work with all of those departments with a very high level of respect. And it's amazing to see, once you force that and once you make it clear that that's the expectation, how much people are happy to fall in line. Certainly understanding you're getting the right people, but I'm on so many meetings where I am amazed at the amount of respect between departments and between levels. And, you know, our vision is to maintain that and to make sure that we have that both internally and externally with our clients. I mean, I've been at agencies where you can be on a client call, and as soon as you hang up, you're talking about the clients, you're talking about how dumb they are, how terrible they are, how limited they are, you know, and there's challenges working with clients, but instead of gossiping about it, we figure out how to work through them. And that's the focus. It's not on putting the client down or the situation down. It's about understanding that that's your guardrail. You have to work with that. And if you just gossip about it, you will not be successful.
Interesting. Also, I think what I find very compelling is that, you know, it sounds like with your name, you know, you are a woman, you're in a leadership role. Was there a teaching perspective of the people that you ended up hiring as part of your team that also, I guess, balanced out the male-dominated industry with advice and collaboration with women? Is there a new demeanor that you're looking at? Because quite often the male domination seems to have failed on many levels, and we haven't been listening to women for a very long time. Is that changing now, and is that informing the industry as well? Because I think it is.
Yeah, I think it's changing. It's not changing as fast as anyone would like. You know, what's interesting is I had an amazing conversation with a woman who's been in this industry for probably 40 or more years. And she was at big agencies. She had really big roles. And you know what she said to me that I found really interesting was that she fought tooth and nail to get a seat at the table, at the board table, and at that top leadership role. But, and to her regret, she had to step on a lot of people to get there and a lot of women to get there. And she had to fight for that one position because there was only one. Now, that's looking back, you know, 30 years, but I can say in my career, I've been at multiple places where that same sentiment is still underlying the field. So women are not supporting women. Women understand still to this day that there's limited positions for them at the top in a lot of cases, and they're fighting each other to maintain their position. Now, what we work on here at Summer Friday, and again, it goes in line with the overall culture that we were speaking about, but the general respect for everyone's personal situation. Now, obviously, we're on Zoom calls every day, seeing each other's living rooms and kids running in the backgrounds and dogs barking. But what we really are talking about is, you know, everybody has personal situations. Everyone has challenges. And we need to support each other and work with each other through them. we can't fight them anymore. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. We have kids quarantined every other week. We have kids home, you know, doing school from home for 100 different reasons. We have husbands in the room next door talking louder over our Zoom calls. There's just everybody has an issue and a challenge. And even if you don't have kids or you do, there's, you know, everyone's dealing with something and we have to have a general respect for that. And we can't challenge each other. We have to work together and back each other up.
I will just add,
you know, I've had multiple conversations with my staff, who's mostly women, about learning how to separate a little bit and take a break, because with the remote culture that we're in, it's very hard to separate yourself from the computer. I have the challenge with my kids. You know, they get home and I just want to do another half hour of work, or I just want to squeeze one more thing in. And putting those guardrails up so you separate work and life is very, very hard, I think, especially for women these days. And learning how to, whether you have to schedule time to, you know, to unplug, or schedule time to focus on your family or your life outside of work. We spend a lot of time working through how to do that. Is it the middle of the day? Is it in the morning? Do you need to log on at 10 instead of 9? Do you need to log off at 5 and maybe back on at 9? You know, and we work with each individual to see what works with them and then communicate that across the board, because I may have an agreement with them, but the creative department doesn't or the clients don't. So we put a plan in place for how to make sure that they're not bothered during their personal time.
Very, very interesting. How do we, evidently in your operation, you've come to a greater balance between men and women and women and men. And how did you accomplish that? Because there may have been an expectation of men being more domineering and eclipsing women. Are women coming together and also supporting each other a little bit more than before because of the demeanor of the firm? So are you getting better results because of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think in our industry, it's very important to have a diversified team. We're putting content out that has to be representative of everyone in society.
Correct.
And if we have a team that is one-sided, all of our content will be as well. So we're very conscious of that. We make sure that we're very well-rounded. And if there's a space that we're lacking, we have, over the last few months especially, put a lot of things in play to make sure that there's a content review component so that we know we're not going to put anything out that offends someone that maybe didn't create it. Making sure that we have that holistic perspective. Because again, the content we put out there, I can write a strategy for Gen Z, which I am not. I can write a strategy for baby boomers, which I am not in that category. I can write a strategy for men who are selling auto insurance. And I have to be able to shift my mindset or talk to people on my team or do a research study to really understand them. So I think the more well-rounded we are internally, the more natural that is, the easier it is to have all of those different perspectives, and then understanding how to find that outside if we don't have it internally.
Well, if you bring that perspective forward for a client, a potential client, do they say, oh, my God, this is an aha moment for them? Is it more balanced? Are they looking for a male voice or a female voice or a little bit of each? Are they looking for a marriage so that, in a sense, between women and men, men and women, so that the message actually reaches out to the message is bolder. It's more vast. It reaches more people. Is that part of the ramifications of the message that you present through your clients?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I don't know. There's a lot of debate in the industry. And when you look at strategies that we build and creative that we put out there, more vast is not always the best solution. Having a respectful understanding of the entire audience is very important, mm-hmm. but you still have to write yeah. and position and direct it towards people that align with your brand. And I think the biggest thing that has come out of the last 2 years is genuine brand positioning and understanding mm-hmm. that we can't write a strategy or, you know, an ad that says something that does not actually resonate within the company or is not actually true. Because in this world of two-way conversations and social backlash, mm-hmm. you know, we have to really spend a lot of time to see who is this company and who are they best fit for, and then write a plan mm-hmm. from there. So it may not always be, you know, entire generations. It may not always be male and female equally. So mm-hmm. we really have to spend a lot of time to understand who we should be talking to and then how we can write to that.
And when you speak to some companies that are thinking of your representing them, are you adopting their demeanor and their self-awareness of who they are, or are you expanding beyond that? And or is that your job, or is it more to replicate their self-understanding of who they are? So is it a balancing act for you?
Yeah, I think it's a little of both. Honestly, there's a lot of cases where a company will come to us with a position that's maybe a little dated, isn't representative of uh-huh. who they are today, or is not bold enough, to be honest. Probably uh-huh. the biggest thing we fight is the goal of a company to be too broad, and we spend a lot of time narrowing it down and uh-huh. focusing it in. So now we can expand over time outside of that, but to begin, especially, the smaller the audience, the more focused we are, generally the easier it is to get those initial responses and advocates, and then you build from there.
Okay, so that's the building block where, in a sense, you prove your capacity even in their own world and the people that they reached out to before. So you just embellish that message. Because it's maybe more focused than it was before. There's a great deal of amorphous thinking that gets lost along the way. So you're just more focused, and then you could develop that into an even bigger campaign. I'm not talking about money necessarily, but just a bigger campaign because it's broader in thinking.
Yeah, I mean, there's a phrase in advertising and marketing that if you're talking to everyone, you're not speaking to anyone. And it really
okay.
comes down to if you stay high level and generic, then you sound
uh-huh.
like everyone else or you don't sound like anyone at all. And so you have to pick a voice, and that voice will resonate with some audiences and not with others. And you have to accept that. And you can build
okay.
out from there. But this is a world where you need advocates. You have to find the people that align most closely with your brand and then
mm-hmm.
speak to them. Build your company around them, and then you can spread from there.
Okay. So when you look at the cadre of companies that are, under your watch and that you work for, is there something that ties them all together? Do they listen? Are they astute with regard to their messaging? These are big companies, and they must be very, very astute and very aware of what's been going on under their watch. So what do you bring to the equation that sparks their interest to become part of your family of companies being represented by you? It could be your personal demeanor or
yeah,
something
I mean,
more complex. I don't know.
I do think that has a lot to do with it because
yes.
we really create an environment mm-hmm. where there are no egos. The clients feel that a lot more than you would ever expect, especially in initial calls. You would think in a couple of first few calls, you know, they would be looking more at capabilities, but generally it's a culture check.
Mm-hmm.
It's, do I want to work
mm-hmm.
with these people? Do I trust
right.
these people? And I think that's
right.
one of the biggest components. But we honestly on our end have the same review process. So we've had clients
mm-hmm.
that we can tell from day one are not going to respect our team. And we cannot build a business where our employees are abused in any way and not appreciated, both internally and externally. So we have clients that we've turned down, even after a couple weeks of scoping and getting to know them and all of that, that we've realized this isn't going to work in the end. And I think what it really comes down to is there mutual respect? Is this a partnership that we can build on over time? And if it's not, then it just won't work. And I think that's really, really hard for most companies to understand, especially when, you know, there's $100,000, there's $1 million on the table in revenue. But we have seen it go both ways too many times, where we understand that $1 million is going to cost us, you know, 6 amazing employees down the line. It's going to kill our culture because people will be abused. People will be upset. People will start complaining. They'll go on our review sites. They'll talk about the agency. You know, that's a reflection of who we are. And so we cannot let negative clients or brands that are going to take advantage of our employees come into the picture.
So your team knows that they've got your back and the back of each other. So that's the family. And yet at the same time, you test out conceivably future clients. And even if there is $1 million on the table, you're not willing to let any of your family members go because they're so, I guess, part of what you're trying to accomplish and what you are accomplishing, evidently. So it's not a trial for you. You already know how to put all this thing together. But that's very unusual, isn't it? Most corporate structure, people are not concerned about the people that work within that department or within the departments. Where did that come from? Is that something that came from your family structure from many, 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 many years ago? I don't know how old you are or how young, but the point is it must have come from someplace. Who informed you?
I mean, I think at the heart of it, it comes from my family and how I've been brought up and, you know, in the same with my partners. I think probably more relevant is that we came from a culture that was not that way. And we saw the repercussions over time. And we saw how it slowly broke down the entire agency. You had, you know, so many people that were leaving because they couldn't take it. They couldn't take the client abuse. All of that. And then they couldn't take the internal ego. So that's why when we founded our company, we really made sure that we weren't going to bring in any of that or allow any of that, like I said, both internally or externally. And I remember very distinctly a call I had over the summer with 2 colleagues. And we sat down and we asked them, do you think you can make this client successful? And this is after 20 minutes of going back and forth. Should we take this client on? Should we not? And my team had a really hard time saying no, a harder time than I did, because they wanted to make it work. They wanted to try to be successful. They didn't want to turn something down. But at the end of the day, you know, what we learned in that conversation was that the heart of the decision came down to, can you form a partnership with this person or this company, and do you see that being successful? And if the answer is no, we walk away today. And they finally, after a 20-minute conversation, said, you're right. I cannot see how this will be successful down the line.
Wow. I don't think a lot of operations think that way. That must make you very, very unique in the industry and I guess in other industries as well. What a wonderful template and evidently a success story, which is very, very exciting. And what moved you to open up your own operation?
I would say, in all honesty, my partner, Rob Simone, he pushed me really hard to do this with him. I was terrified. I mean, it's April 2020. I was terrified for 1,000 reasons. Certainly supporting my family through it and working with kids at home through the pandemic was one of many. But you know, he really pushed me thinking that our partnership and the partnership with the other 2 people that we work with and the relationships that we've built with our clients and our employees was enough to go out on a limb. We had employees that had no jobs all of a sudden, clients that had no agency. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we had an opportunity to pick up those pieces and make something of it. And we chose to only pick up the pieces that we thought were going to work and fit this culture. So we could have, you know, we could have started much larger, but we really wanted to narrow in on where we thought we were best and stay there, which I think is another thing a lot of agencies don't do. They're constantly trying mm-hmm. to reach and expand on what they can do. And generally, they're reaching way too far. Honestly, mm-hmm. we're very happy at our size. We do not need to grow. We don't need new business. We don't need to do RFPs. We are all very happy with the role we have. And coming from that position allows us to continue to maintain that culture and that selective nature that we have.
Oh, absolutely a brilliant concept and well executed, evidently, as a testimonial of all the people that work with you and you work with them. It's just huge. What a great success. And just amazing. I'm honored even to be able to speak to you about this because we haven't spoken to people in the advertising business, in the promotion business. And it's an eye-opener for me, certainly, because I remember the good old days. I'm not a spring chicken myself. Well, not that you aren't, but the point is, I'm 72 years old, and I remember the good old days, which weren't so good. So this is a breath of fresh air. And so it's great. You seem to have a sense of comfort, but also a great deal of hunger to maintain, the level of accomplishment that you've achieved. But also, it seems that you constantly question where you are at all times. Is that really the biggest challenge, to see if you're actually meeting the demands of your own and those of your people that we work with and those that you work for? Is that the challenge?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that every agency pushes against. You cannot mm-hmm. be complacent in this business. The people no. around you, the culture around you moves too quickly. You have to yeah. constantly reevaluate even a successful campaign. Even uh-huh. if we are exceeding expectations, we have to review it and say, what can we do better or how can we do it differently? And that's one of our mm-hmm. mantras internally too is, you know, when we're looking, like I referenced the review process, but that's just one example. Yes. When we look at our promotions, our relationships and everything, we're constantly asking, this is how we did it last time. Is this the right way to do it? Is there a different way? And uh-huh. that's hard because you get comfortable, you get busy, you get focused on other things, but we're constantly stopping and looking around and making sure that this is the best way, or encouraging people to go out on a limb and fail intentionally, because it's through those failures okay. that they'll learn.
Well, one last question, because I think we're a little bit over our time slot as well. What is it? You evidently recognize that there's a constant change. Is that the way life really is? It's constantly changing, except that so many companies do not recognize the changes, and that's how they fall out of step with their clients that they want to serve, as well as the people with whom they work. You evidently seem to be on top of the constant change. Is that something new for a lot of people? Do they recognize the change?
I don't know if it's new. I think that it's hard. It's mm-hmm. easy to keep doing things the way you've done them, especially when you have right. a lot on your plate, especially when you're busy, especially when it's working. It's right. looking at those small nuances underneath and understanding how to predict where that's leading or where it could go or the potential on the other side. That's what we're constantly fighting against. And I have, my entire career, I've been at smaller agencies, and I'm always hesitant to bring in someone from a large agency because it's easy to be complacent there. It's easy to follow a process. In some cases, you have to follow a process. And while processes are important for a lot of reasons, they also build complacency. And that is something that is not going to help us build this agency for the next 20 or 30 years.
Fascinating. Well, how do people get in touch with Summer Friday? And that's a very unusual name. How did you come up with Summer Friday?
Well, if you look back...
Was it during the summer and it was on a Friday you made that decision?
No. So if you look back, you reference the good old days in the agency business from long ago. You know, there were a lot of great components of the ad business, but one of the mm-hmm. most interesting ones was how advertising before anyone else implemented Summer Fridays. And that's one thing that corporations, especially around New York, have started to adapt over the last 10 years. But it really was something that started in the ad business. And so we wanted to take a look at, you know, what are the good things in this business and what are some of the best things in this business? Certainly, I think if you talk to anyone, Summer Fridays are at the top of the list.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for making the time for us and our audience. And hopefully we didn't scare you off, and you might even consider coming back again.
Yes,
so,
of course. This has
all
been
the best
great.
To you.
Yes, you too. Thank you very much.
No, I didn't mean to cut you off. Is there a way for people to reach out to Summer Friday?
Yes. So our website is heysummerfriday.com. You can always go there, or you can reach me directly at alicia.wiedemann@heysummerfriday.com. But my contact information and our general contact information is on the site as well.
Cool. So it's hey, H-E-Y, rather than H-A-Y. Is that it?
Yes.
It's important for those of us who are challenged spelling.
Yes, H-E-Y, summerfriday.com.
Perfect. Thanks again. Have a wonderful, wonderful day, and thank you for making the time for us. What a pleasure.
Yes.
Be well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You too.
Well, thank you, Ms. Wiedemann. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right.
Have a great day.
Well, there we have it, folks. Thank you. You too. So Alicia Wiedemann, she's based in Tarrytown, New York. She's the head of client strategy at the ad agency known as Summer Friday. And you can always listen to this podcast or broadcast afterwards. It's on live, but then it's also on, so you can listen in at a later stage. And hopefully we've done her well. It's so compelling. So it's good to hear people who have a tremendous amount of understanding of what they do, how they do it, and what their purpose is, because most people don't reflect back. And I think that's what's the most compelling aspect of everything. Well, we were going to speak today to none other than Delphin Musler. Unfortunately, he has some family issues that need to be taken care of, so we wish him well. And we'll move on to the next stage of what we wanted to cover then with you. And bear with me a moment because I need to find out where we are. Here we are again at our studio screen, which is very, very pertinent. And this is something that really is quite important. The Russians are coming, and Sweden's on edge as Russia flexes its military muscle. Something to think about. I think that people don't think about it as much. So not long after Russia began its massive troop buildup along Ukraine's border, several Russian amphibious warfare ships briefly moved into the Baltic Sea waters, and some of them coming uncomfortably close to Sweden. That and a series of recent drone flights of unknown origin over the country's nuclear power plants has put Sweden on edge, reawakening long-standing fears of a possible Russian incursion. Well, the Swedish Armed Forces reported in mid-January that six Russian amphibious warfare ships had left their naval base in Kaliningrad, a Russian enclave wedged between Poland and Lithuania, and entered the Baltic Sea. Although it is not unusual for Russian vessels to move into the area, the number of them moving in and out was out of the ordinary. Sweden immediately took the move as a warning and signal, referring to the, quote, changing security situation in Europe and the Baltic Sea area, and responded by swiftly boosting its military presence on the southeastern Swedish island of Gotland, G-O-T-L-A-N-D, which means God's land. And within 48 hours, the island of 60,000 inhabitants swarmed with patrolling soldiers and armored tanks in a scene not seen in decades. It used to be quite common to see the military there, but that's really not the case anymore. And these days, it really surprises one, or surprises an inhabitant, said, he told the Daily National newspaper, Dagens Nyheter. Anyway, around the same time, Swedish police received several reports of particularly large drones flying over Sweden's three nuclear plants, Oskarshamn, Ringhals, and Forsmark, as well as over at least two airports, the Greater Stockholm area and the Royal Family Palace in Drottningholm. Now, the origin of the drones have not been identified, and on January 17th, the Swedish intelligence agency announced that it had taken over the investigation. Well, the incidents have made Sweden very nervous. In the past few weeks, speculation has been running high about what a potential threat from Russia might mean for this small country of only 10 million people. And while some newspapers have been discussing how long Sweden's defense could hold out in the event of a Russian attack, others have analyzed the underlying reasons for why Sweden might be an interesting military target. Some media have also hosted live chats in which defense experts have taken questions from worried members of the public about the increasingly tense security situation in the region. Discussion over whether Sweden should join NATO has also resurfaced, as they do every few years, but this time around, debate has been further fueled by Russia's insistence that the transatlantic military alliance not take in any new members, notably Ukraine. Now, although the socialist-run government has recently reiterated its long-held stance that Sweden shall remain alliance-free, quote-unquote, most Swedes feel that NATO membership should be a Swedish and not a Russian decision. On Monday, Sweden's foreign minister, Ann Linde, and her Finnish counterpart, Pekka Haavisto, whose country is not a NATO member either, demonstrated this point by meeting with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg in Brussels for, quote, dialogue, end quote, and on, quote, deepening partnership, end quote. Well, Sweden's fear of Russia dates back hundreds of years, mainly stemming from conflicting expansion plans over what is now Finland. Russia eventually won, stealing Sweden's status as a European superpower. And since then, the Russians are coming, Riesen komma, that's the Swedish version, has become a common Swedish expression. At the height of the Cold War in the 1980s, and as the former Soviet Union and the United States raced to become the world's foremost nuclear superpower, Sweden's proximity to Russia and several sightings of suspected Russian submarines in the Stockholm archipelago brought Swedish fears to a fever pitch. Malin Rising, a Swedish journalist who grew up in the coastal town of Nineshamn, recalled the tensions. Quote, he says, I remember how my friends and I would climb up on the cliffs and look out over the Baltic Sea to see if we could spot any Russian submarines. And that was just how we played back then, she said. I didn't realize Malin was a female name. So I also remember people discussing where to find the nearest bomb shelter in case the Russians came. Now, some of the shelters have since been converted into data server centers, a symbol of Sweden's shifting perception of the dangers posed by Russia. In 2010, more than 20 years after the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, the Swedish fear of the Russians had dissipated somewhat, and the government decided to mothball the mandatory military service that had been in place since 1901. But just 7 years later, the country decided to reactivate military conscription. They cited Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in 2014 and increased military activity in Sweden's vicinity. The country also decided to make the conscription gender neutral and to restore a garrison on the island of Gotland. Well, let's talk about Gotland. The island of Gotland and its strategic geographic location in the Baltic Sea is currently at the core of Sweden's Russian fears. It lies just 300 kilometers north of the Kaliningrad and naval base and face the three Baltic and former Soviet states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania to the east. In other words, whoever controls Gotland has free access to the Baltic countries. But there is more of it. And all three Baltic states are NATO members, meaning that fellow NATO members, including the United States, would be obligated to come to their defense in the event of an attack under Article 5. Quote, to help its allies, the Americans would have to send jets over fast and fly over the Baltic Sea. But if the Russians gained control of Gotland, they could use anti-aircraft missiles and coastal robots, making it extremely difficult for the Americans to reach and defend the Baltics, explained Magnus Christiansson, a researcher in military strategy at the Swedish Defense University. Christiansson said that a Russian takeover of the Baltic states would be devastating for the world order. Quote, it would totally crush NATO's credibility. There would be nothing left of it, seeing as it is built on Article 5. All for one, one for all. It would be a catastrophe, he said. And Christiansson added that if it turned out that the Russians were actually behind the reported drone flights, it would most likely have been an attempt to intimidate the Swedes. Nothing else. Of course, they already know where the power plants are, and doesn't just about everyone know where the royal palace is. He joked, "This is just a really cheap way to get someone out of balance. It's psychological." By January 18, all six Russian amphibious warships had left the Baltic Sea. But the Swedish troops on Gotland remain in place. So we're going to have to see where all this goes. Now, this is very, very interesting. Russia evidently launches a new military drills near Ukraine in the annexed area of known as Crimea. Russia on yesterday, launched new military exercises near Ukraine and in annexed Crimea, as it accused the United States of ratcheting up tensions by putting several thousand of its own troops on alert. With the West already accusing Russia of massing more than 100,000 soldiers in the Ukraine on the Ukrainian border, the Russian military said it had launched drills involving 6,000 troops in the south and in the Crimean Peninsula annexed by Moscow in 2014. The drills involved combat firing exercises with fighter jets, bombers, anti-aircraft systems, and ships from the Black Sea and Caspian fleets, the ministry had said. The West is accusing Russia of preparing a potential invasion of pro-Western Ukraine, and tensions with Moscow have reached levels not seen since the Cold War. After a long video call with European leaders on Monday, U.S. President Joe Biden said there was, quote, total unanimity, end quote, on how to deal with Russia, with officials warning against severe consequences if Moscow invades. The Pentagon said it had put 8,500 troops on standby for deployment in support of NATO, while the alliance said it was sending ships and jets to bolster Eastern Europe's defenses. President Vladimir Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that U.S. moves were adding to an already tense atmosphere. The United States is escalating tensions, he told reporters. We are watching these U.S. actions with great concern. Russia denies it has any plans to invade Ukraine, where as well as seizing Crimea It has backed separatist forces in two breakaway regions, Donetsk and I forgot the other area. Moscow has instead accused the West of increasing tensions with deployments and support for Ukraine, a former Soviet republic. Russia has put forward a list of security demands, including a guarantee that Ukraine never be allowed to join NATO and that alliance forces pull back in Eastern European countries that joined the bloc after the Cold War. Well, the United States and NATO have rejected the demands and told Russia to withdraw from Ukraine's borders, warning that an attack will trigger damaging economic sanctions as well as a beefed-up NATO presence in Eastern Europe. A series of talks in various European countries or cities this month have failed to ease tensions, though U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov agreed at a meeting in Geneva on Friday to keep talking. Well, the United States has promised to provide written answers to Moscow's demands this week, but has rejected calls for a ban on possible NATO expansion as a non-starter. The crisis has laid bare divisions in the West, with some European Union members appearing less willing to take severe action against Russia, which supplies about 40% of the bloc's natural gas supplies. But there are other supplies. The new government in European Union economic powerhouse Germany in particular has faced criticism from Kiev over its refusal to send defensive weapons to Ukraine, as well as hesitating over one of the harshest economic sanctions under discussion, cutting Moscow from the global SWIFT payment system. Biden held a 1 hour and 20 minute video conference with allied leaders from Europe and NATO on Monday, telling reporters afterwards, quote, "I had a very, very, very good meeting, total unanimity with all the European leaders." There were hopes for some easing of tensions after the French government announced that Russian and Ukrainian officials would meet along with French and German counterparts on Wednesday, that's today, to try to find a way out of the impasse. Well, the U.S. has stepped up security assistance to Ukraine, with Blinken on a visit to Kiev last week confirming another $200 million in aid. A shipment arrived on Saturday, and another batch was due on Tuesday, which the United States said would include, quote, equipment and munitions to bolster the defense capacity of the Ukrainian armed forces. The United States has warned that Moscow could manufacture a false flag incident in Ukraine to be able to then frame an invasion as a justified response. Ukraine said on Tuesday it had dismantled a group of saboteurs coordinated by Russian special services who had planned a, quote, series of armed attacks, end quote, aimed at destabilizing the country. Now, Ukraine's SBU security service said it had seized weapons and arrested two residents, one of them a Russian citizen, operating in eastern and central Ukraine. My goodness, things are really heating up. We'll see. It's only Wednesday. Who knows what's going to happen later on in the week. One second. This is very, very important as well. It seems that Germany, Sweden, and Poland have tossed out Russian diplomats in retaliation for Moscow's expulsion last week of their diplomats for allegedly taking part in protests in support of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The three European Union countries announced the tit-for-tat moves in coordinated statements, drawing an angry response from Russia, which accused them of meddling in its internal affairs. The diplomatic spat comes at a time of heightened tensions between the European Union and Russia, exacerbated by the arrest and jailing of leading opposition figure Navalny. Russia humiliated the European Union on Friday by announcing the expulsion during a rare meeting in Moscow between European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Well, European governments strongly condemned the shock expulsions, with Berlin warning that it would respond in kind. Moscow's decision to expel the three diplomats was in no way justified, the German foreign ministry said on Monday, adding that the German staff member had been doing his job of, quote, observing developments in Russia by lawful means. Well, Swedish Foreign Minister Ann Linde said that Stockholm had, quote, informed the Russian ambassador that a person from the Russian embassy is asked to leave Sweden, end quote. Quote, this is a clear response to the unacceptable decision to expel a Swedish diplomat who was only performing his duties, she wrote on Twitter. The Polish Foreign Ministry likewise condemned the groundless expulsion of a Polish diplomat from St. Petersburg and said it had declared, quote, persona non grata, end quote, a Russian consular official in Poznan, Western Poland. Well, the Russian Foreign Ministry immediately hit back. Quote, today's decision by Poland, Germany, and Sweden are unfounded, unfriendly, and are a continuation of the very series of actions that the West is taking with regard to our country and which we qualify as interference in our internal affairs, spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said on a state channel known as Russia One or Russia One. The Kremlin earlier on Monday defended the expulsion of the European Union diplomats during Borrell's high-profile visit and insisted it remain interested in reviving relations with Brussels. Well, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that the declaration of the three foreign diplomats as persona non grata was, quote, a consequence of the actions of some diplomatic missions in Moscow against the backdrop of illegal riots, end quote. Moscow added that Peskov added that Moscow did not initiate the collapse, end quote, of the relationship with the European Union. Russia has been and remains interested in reviving relations between Moscow and Brussels, he told reporters. Navalny, a fierce critic of President Vladimir Putin, was arrested upon arrival in Moscow on January 17 after spending several months in Germany recovering from a poisoning as the West believes was ordered by the Kremlin. He was jailed for nearly 3 years last week for violating a parole condition while in Germany. And tens of thousands of Russians have taken to the streets in recent weeks to protest against Putin's 20-year rule and demand Navalny's release, triggering a fierce police crackdown on demonstrators. Western leaders, too, have called for Navalny to be freed immediately. Russia has bristled at the international backing for Navalny, accusing Europe and the United States of interfering in its domestic affairs. And the European Union's Borrell is expected to meet with foreign ministers from the 27 member states on February 22 to discuss fresh sanctions against Moscow that would require a unanimous vote among the European Union members. Unbelievable. This is really going through the roof, what's happening on the international stage. So it's going to be very cumbersome, to say the least. One second. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of the wire here. Won't be able to speak to you about other issues as well, but we're close to the end of our time slot with you. Let me quickly look to see what's going on tomorrow. Tomorrow is Thursday. We're going to be speaking to the Driving Me Crazy duo by the name of none other, John and Lori Wiles. They'll be on from 10 to 10:30, and then at 10:30, we're going to be speaking to Brian Harrod, who is the publisher and editor of Yonkers Newswire. So that should be very, very compelling indeed. So hopefully you'll join us then. In the meantime, we're going to go back to our studio screen, assuming I can find it. Here it is, I think. And we're going to say goodbye. And thank you all for being with us today. Goodbye.